The first thing I want us to review, there were a couple of terms that I wanted us to know and to understand. Anybody remember what those two terms were? Very good. Microevolution and macroevolution. Microevolution, small changes within the same kind of organism. Macroevolution is addition of new traits so as to transition into a new and different organism. Micro, remember, is small. Microscope, you use it to see small things. Macro is large. We noted that people, animals, and plants can and do change over time within certain limits. And so microevolution, as it's called, is small changes within that same organism, same kind of plant or animal. We noted that we as humans, we're all different. It's amazing to me, we've got what? 7 billion people on the planet? And yet they can do facial recognition. All of our faces are different, different characteristics. We're individuals. So there are small changes, but we don't evolve into some other life form. A fish doesn't, as we talked about a trout down here in Taneycomo, doesn't eventually change into a whale out in the ocean. So those changes are micro, small changes within that same kind of family. Microevolution is a fact. It is observable and it does take place. Macroevolution, on the other hand, is not a fact. It is not observable and it doesn't take place, no matter what they tell you. I think Johnny was here last week and he did mention the fact that there's lots of fossils that have been found. But there aren't any fossils of transitional plants, animals, people. They've tried to come up with some, but they've never succeeded. And if evolution takes place slowly over millions and billions of years, there should be lots of fossil evidence showing a cow as part of a cow and part elephant or whatever. But we don't have that. Why? Because it didn't happen. One of the things we also noticed last week was talking about Darwin's finches. Darwin went on a voyage, and he kept track of the plants and animals that he saw. And one of the things he noticed is in these finches is that there were a lot of varieties. Here's are just a few of the shapes of different bills of finches. You've got some that are thick, some that are skinny and narrow, and they eat different types of food. And so he reasoned that they all came from a common ancestor, and that over a period of time, these differences took place. Well, that part of it is true. They did come from a common ancestor. God, in Genesis, created the male and female finch. Within their gene pool, there was a variety of different colors, different shapes of bills, beaks, and so on. So over time, either the birds adapted to the food that was around them, or they began to eat the food that was conducive to whatever beak that they had. The big guy up there on the top left, he may have been eating seeds or nuts and be able to break them. The little guy there on the bottom right, he probably eating berries and those type of things, so he's not really conducive to chomping down real hard, looks like. But no matter what changes took place over a period of time, guess what? They're still finches. They haven't changed into another life form. They haven't changed into an eagle. They're just a finch. Microevolution, small changes within the same kind of organism. This is what God created. This is what God allows. And so when people like Darwin, begin to look at microevolution, changes in a particular family or species of animal or plant, they take it the next step and say, okay, that proves macroevolution. It doesn't. And so when people are talking about these small changes, a lot of times that's a proof that they use to say, yes, evolution took place, meaning that we eventually came from a one-celled amoeba to all the plants and animals we have today. That didn't happen. This next slide is a slide of kind of what they're showing, to show the amoeba down on the bottom right, and then from that, everything came into place. This doesn't show the plant life, this just shows some of the animals. But God, in Genesis chapter 1, verses 11 and 12, says, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. Notice the word kind. God uses this over and over again in the first chapter in describing the animals and the plants. He says the grass grows after its kind, the herb grows after its kind, and the fruit tree yields after its kind. How many different varieties of apples are there? Several. I have no idea. Peaches. But does a apple tree eventually turn into a peach tree? No. But there are different varieties of apples. And so we see that God made within its own kind, the seed reproduces after its own kind, but there are variables. They're not just exact duplicates of the previous, there are certain characteristics that can be changed. And so we know with animals, if we breed them often enough, we can have a new breed of a dog or a cat. But they're still a dog or they're still a cat, no matter how many times that they're bred. So God created great sea creatures and everything that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. So the birds, there's different kinds of birds. There are different types of creatures that are in the ocean. You don't have a seal that ends up being a whale. You may have varieties of seals. You may have varieties of whales. But they don't change from one kind to another. Let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. God saw that it was good. So here we see that God created the different plants, the different animals, and he allowed them to adapt, to change, again, within certain limits. You don't have one kind changing into a different kind, as evolution says happened. When God created different types or kinds of plants and animals, he built into the DNA, or the genetic code, the ability of the species to change and adapt within certain limits, so as to survive as their environment changes. That's microevolution that takes place. That's what Darwin was seeing when he saw these different types of finches. They've adapted, they've changed. But you can't take that and say, okay, they came from a one-celled amoeba. That didn't happen. That does not mean that one organism or kind of plant or animal can change into a completely different organism or kind of plant or animal. That is micro or macro evolution, and that doesn't happen. During creation, God allowed for microevolution, or small changes, as we see in the differences of the shape and size of the finches' bills. What God did not allow is for macroevolution, or large changes, which allows one kind of plant or animal to change into a completely different kind, as Darwin and evolutionists propose. As we mentioned, there are variations of cats. Lots of different breeds. Have no idea how many different breeds there are, but they're all still cats. There are variations of dogs, but they're still dogs. There are variations of horses, but they're still all horses. You can just go on and on and on. Dave Lewis keeps me on my toes. He's always asking me questions, bringing up scriptures, asking me if I'm going to be talking about this or that. And sometimes he brings up in class, he says, what about this verse? I said, we'll get to it. Well, last week he brought up, what about this verse? And I didn't have it. So I've added it in there. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul is answering a question about death and resurrection. And you may think, well, what does that have to do with creation and evolution? Well, let's read what it says. But someone will say, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come? Foolish one, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies. And what you sow, you do not sow that body that shall be, but mere grain, perhaps wheat or some other grain. But God gives it a body as he pleases, and to each seed its own body. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there's one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animal, another of fish, and another of birds. Well, that's what Dave was wanting me to point out. God says we're not all the same. We didn't come from one cell, amoeba, and we're just all variations of that. He created us different from the very beginning. Our flesh is completely different. And so evolution is not part of God's plan. It's not something that God did. Paul was answering the question about the dead, how they're raised, and what kind of body they're going to have. The seed that is sown is not the body that will be raised. You plant a little seed, and we know that we've been told that the seed dies before life begins. And that's what it's saying here. The first form dies. It's gone away with. And something new comes up from that. We don't know what our resurrected bodies are going to look like. Have no idea. But we do know they're going to be perfect. And so we have to die. We have to be planted, as it were, and then raised again. And whatever shape that is, that's up to God. But we have different types of flesh. The flesh of men, the flesh of animals, the fish, the birds are all different. We didn't evolve from one ancestor millions and billions of years ago. Evolutionists have taken the fact of microevolution and say that is proof of macroevolution. So today, when somebody talks about evolution, generally they're talking about huge genetic changes turning one kind of animal into a completely different kind of animal. They are talking about macroevolution, which has never been seen or proven. And so don't be fooled when they begin to give you proofs like the finches, bills. That's not proof of macroevolution. That's just proof of God's plan from the very beginning. There's variations within the same kind of animal. But it doesn't mean that they ever step from one kind to another kind. No matter what changes Darwin saw in the shape and size of the bills of the finches, they were still finches.
And how do we know God didn't make the difference? Why do you want to give them credit?
Give who credit?
The evolutionists. Why even call it micro-evolution?
Well, this is just basically micro. Evolution is just a change. That's all that means. We've taken the word evolution and made it into something bigger and grander than what it is. Evolution just means change in its basic form. As we've talked about, change, things change. How many different, again, types of dogs are there? How many different types of horses are there? A lot of them have been bred by humans. Those were changes that were made by us. Now, some of them happened, as we say, naturally. How many different varieties of finches did God make? I really don't know. But I do know he only made one male and one female human. And look at the varieties that we have in humans.
Can you imagine, Bob, if we did not all keep the same flesh, what kind of thing this world would be civilized with? Populated with? Why, it'd be, you wouldn't know a human being from a half human over here, a quarter human. I mean, can we figure out what chaos would be?
One thing we need to remember, and we've talked about this before, is that as humans, God made us in his image. That doesn't mean that we physically look like God, but I believe mentally, yes. We have a conscience. We're able to think. We're able to reason. We know right from wrong. We're the only thing on this planet that can really evaluate and think about ourselves. A horse doesn't think about itself. A whale doesn't think about itself. It doesn't analyze itself, what it's thinking or why it's thinking or why it's here and those type of things. We can, and we do. God has given us that ability. Yes?
Well, I mean, at one point in time, yes, all the animals and everything, you know, the first 7 days, everything was created. But then, at one point in time, there were only two.
Mm-hmm.
And they all went on the ark.
Yep.
And then they adapted, and we have...
Yep. Yeah, we start off, again, we're assuming. God doesn't give us a lot of details about the creation. You know, it's just amazing to me. You take something, a grand event like creation, and he talks about it in what? One chapter, for the most part. Then he starts chapter two and kind of adds a little more details, information. There's lots of questions we have. But as Amy said, no matter how many he created on day of creation, how many finches, they ended up with two on the ark. And so all those variabilities, all those changes had to be within that genetic code, within that kind of animal. And what do you call it? Micro changes? What do you call it? Micro evolution? Whatever you want to call it, evolution just means change. But we've taken it, for the most part, when we say evolution, the first thing you think of is apes to man. And that's what they want you to think. That's what they want the kids to think. And so again, evolve is another word. I mean, we use evolve in a different forms and ways all the time. That's the reason I think it's so important that we understand micro changes or evolution, and we understand macro changes or evolution. So that when somebody starts talking about evolution, you can kind of pinpoint them and say, well, that's just microevolution. That's micro changes within the same family, within the same kind. That's not proof of these finches changing into, like I said, an eagle. Doesn't happen. Or they didn't come from an earthworm. Remember how the finches got here in the first place, according to evolution. I'm not sure what their lineage is going back. That's the reason I try to emphasize that. Micro, macro. Macro is the theory of evolution. That is the changing from a one-celled amoeba to all those animals we saw on the chart up to mankind. That did not happen. And there's no proof that it happened. Scientific observation has never produced a single shred of evidence that proves even the possibility of huge genetic changes turning one kind of animal into another. That's important. There's not one shred of evidence. But yet they teach it and tell it just like it's fact.
And you could be sure they've been tried.
Oh, they have tried. Oh, yes. That they have. Yes.
One reason I ask, and sometimes I ask you questions because I'm not sure if I remember if you covered it, and it might be the same to this thing I want to bring up.
Go ahead.
I just glanced and said people over the last century have been led to believe that if they wish to be educated, they too should believe in evolution, and so they do. Now, well, how naive, but then think about religion.
Well, part of that, you know, we went through the Gallup poll that was done in 2009, and that's one of the things we noticed. The more of a formal education that people had, the more likely they were to believe in the theory of evolution. And part of that comes down to either peer pressure, they're either didn't have a faith in God to start off with, or they began to lose their faith in God. But on the other hand, the more that people went to church services, the more likely they were to believe in creation and not believe in evolution. So yeah, it goes hand in hand. And one of the things, I think, as far as the formal education, again, not knocking formal education, we just have to be aware of what's out there, is that there's a lot of peer pressure. And they can place a lot of doubt in your mind. When you're just fed one side of the story over and over and over again, pretty soon you begin to think, well, maybe the Bible's not telling the whole story. And that's why it's important that we teach our children and they have a firm foundation that when they go to these schools, go out into the world, they can say, no, that's not true. That's not what the Bible says.
When our mind goes past reason, though, imagination takes over.
Mm-hmm. Right. In fact, all the observable evidence proves just the opposite, that every living organism reproduces according to its kind, just as we read in Genesis chapter 1, just as God said. Again, we have bred horses, we've bred cattle, we've bred dogs, we've bred cats for centuries upon centuries upon centuries. And we still have dogs, cats, horses, and cows. Lots of variety, but they're the still same kind of animal that God created in the beginning.
Even when scientists try cloning sheep, it comes out of sheep.
Right. Yep.
You know, they can't make it into half something and half something else.
Any other questions, comments?
Occasionally you hear of a deformity.
Oh, yeah.
Which happens once in a while.
Yep. No matter the evidence, evolutionists believe that given enough time, beneficial mutations do happen, and that is the driving force behind nature being able to produce new creatures from old ones. That's what they always go back to, time. That's the reason they say it took billions of years for the universe to form and for all the life to form. If there's any slight chance that they could be right, they have to have that time, and they know that. And we're going to talk about that time in another lesson. They don't have all those billions of years, and we'll see why.
Well, why don't we see things
happening? Right.
If that's the case.
Right.
I mean, we've lived long enough, and we've been studying this long enough to have found something that's evolving to something else.
Right.
And
we right. Yeah, we've got centuries of history, and there's not anything we've seen, anything that looks like it's changing from one form to another. Again, going back to the fossil record, there's nothing there either. Time is the key to evolution, and they know it. Without time, without billions of years, there's no way that anyone could even remotely conceive of evolution. And that's why we're told that it's billions upon billions of years that all this stuff took place, as if they can prove that. It is a fact that mutations do occur. But most mutations are so detrimental to the organism that the organism dies. There's very few beneficial mutations that happen naturally in nature. Some. But that's what they base their whole theory upon. Time and these beneficial mutations somehow improve the plants, the animals. But then you always get back to that one question. Where did it all begin? How did matter get here to start off with? And then how did life start from non-life, if there was nothing here at one time? Some scientists have thought, what if we could speed up the evolution process and find some way to introduce millions upon millions of mutations into an organism's gene pool and prove that evolution's true? Is there a way to speed up the evolutionary process? Well, they've been searching, trying to find a way. If evolution is actually true, and we could find an organism that could be genetically manipulated satisfactorily, then we should be able to reproduce evolution in the lab. Well, they found such an organism. What is that organism? The fruit fly. And you may say, well, what in the world are you talking about? Well, the common fruit fly has several characteristics that make it the perfect specimen for laboratory mutation experiments. Remember, they're basing their theory upon time. And over time, these mutations took place. And these mutations improved the species. Improved them so much, in fact, that they'd be turned into something else eventually. So, the fruit fly, the female can lay up to 50 eggs a day, or about 2,000 eggs in a lifetime, which is a little over 1 month. It grows from an egg to an adult in 10 to 12 days, producing up to 30 generations per year. So over a long period of time, they can take these fruit flies, introduce mutations, and if their theory is correct, what should happen? The fruit fly should change into something else.
It just changed into a worse house. Irradiate demon and get little wings on one side and wing on the other.
Yep, they just ended up with the fruit fly after it all ends. Since the early 1900s, multiplied millions of fruit fly generations have been bred in laboratories around the world. So this is not just one little experiment someplace. This is scientists all around the world has been doing this because they want to prove evolution so bad. Scientists performing these experiments have introduced fruit flies, as Verd was saying, to various levels of radiation, chemicals, countless other factors designed to produce mutations with the hopes of creating changes that would bring about a new species. The mutations that occurred resulted in such physical characteristics as eyeless flies, flies with different colored eyes, flies with legs growing from their heads, extra pair of wings, various colored bodies, wingless flies, flies with unusually large wings, flies with useless wings, flies with twisted wings, and you can just go on and on and on. These are the mutations that have occurred in these generations after generations after generations after generations of fruit flies. So extensive have fruit fly experiments been that the massive number of generations produced and the mutations created would be the equivalent of millions of years of supposed evolutionary time. They wanted time. They said it takes time. So they take this fruit fly, it doesn't live very long, and like I said, they can have generations, thousands upon generations in these last 100 years. Furthermore, we must remember that intelligent scientists have acted upon the mutations, thus speeding up the accumulation of so-called beneficial mutations. These mutations did not just occur by accident. In the theory of evolution, we're here by an accident. There was no mastermind behind it. We're just fortunate we're even here. And yet here we've got intelligent people acting upon these fruit flies, introducing mutations after mutations after mutations, and said something's got to be producing something different here. But it didn't. If evolution by genetic mutation and natural selection really can occur, we should discover that the fruit flies mutated into several new kinds of organisms. We should see creatures that are at least part fly and part something else, like you see in some science fiction movie. So what is it that they have found after all these years of experiments, mutations? Fruit flies. There hasn't been a single one that changed from a fruit fly into a different kind or species of animal. There is no fruit that's half fruit fly and half bird. It didn't happen. I wonder why. Because God didn't create them that way. After hundreds of years of experimentation, thousands of lab-induced mutations and multiplied millions of flies, and intelligent selection acting upon those mutations, the world's most brilliant minds have not been able to produce any kind or different kind of creatures from the fruit fly. It was stated when talking about the late evolutionist Richard Goldsmith, it was said about him, after observing mutations in fruit flies for many years, Goldsmith fell into despair. The changes, he lamented, were so hopelessly, what? Micro, that if 1,000 mutations were combined in one specimen, there would still be no new species. His bubble was burst. He just knew that if we could reproduce these fruit flies and introduce all these mutations, there had to be a new species come from that. But the changes were so what? Micro. So small that no new species came about. Why? Because macroevolution does not exist. It doesn't happen. They just came up with deformed fruit flies. The bottom line of all these experiments ever done on fruit flies is no matter how many changes take place, they stay fruit flies. The results of such experimentation fly in the face of evolution. But they are exactly what one would expect to find if the biblical story or account of creation is true. In Genesis 1, the Bible states that God made all flying creatures and land animals on days 5 and 6 of the creation week. In the creation model, the Bible specifically states that all organisms were to multiply according to their own kind. We read that earlier. After their own kind. They don't change from one kind to another. No matter how many years you spend, how many mutations you introduce, they stay that kind of animal. Thus, one would expect fruit flies, regardless of the number of mutations introduced and selected, to be bound to reproduce only after their own kind, just as God stated, which is exactly what the last 100 years of fruit fly research has shown. They're still fruit flies. These experiments have proven that God's word is true and evolution is false. It's amazing how menacingly a little fruit fly can bug those who adhere to evolution. No matter what the evolutionists tell us, evolution cannot account for the origin of life. And it never will. Evolutionists know that life begets life. Yet they still believe in and promote the theory of evolution, which says that billions of years ago, that life somehow came from non-life. I mentioned that a minute ago. The universe just exploded and everything happened. Well, where did that material come from? If all of that was non-life, how did life get here if life comes from life? Bang. Yeah, it all comes back to the very beginning. How did it accidentally get here? By the end of the 19th century, there was general agreement that life cannot rise from non-living under conditions that now exist upon our planet. The dictum, all life from pre-existing life, became the dogma of modern biology from which no reasonable man could be expected to dissent, said by David Kirk. No reasonable man can say that life comes from non-life. Yet that's what they tell us, and they want us to believe. There is no serious doubt that biogenesis is the rule, that life comes only from other life, that a cell, the unit of life, is always and exclusively the product or offspring of another cell. These are scientists saying these things. Life comes from life. Life does not come from non-life. They know that. Even though they acknowledge that only life begets life, they proclaim there was an exception at the beginning of time when non-life beget life. Now that's scientific. Okay, we're going to end there on this lesson. Got a few more things to talk about on this one, and we'll start our next class, next lesson. But we see that when they talk about evolution, they really have no backing. It's just something that they believe in, and they don't have a lot of proof to back it up. But yet, when we see it and read about it, in our lives every day, it is presented as fact. And if you doubt it, there's something wrong with you. And we talked about this earlier, in the fact in our schools. If they're so sure of themselves, and there's no doubt, why is it they fight so hard not to have creation taught in schools? Why is it they don't want some other idea put up against it? Because when creation is put up against evolution, evolution falls. It doesn't stand. And they know it.